सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। वी ऑफन डिस्कस्ड इकोनॉमिक ग्रोथ एंड डेवलपमेंट इन सोच विचार एंड वी ऑफन टॉक्ड अबाउट इंस्टीट्यूशंस being very important in getting an economy working. Talked about why nations fail and that famous book which talks about how institutions and the state should be developed. Well, today we want to go deeper into what institutions mean. And what we're going to talk about is, to my mind, the most important subject in this country, and I think most of you will agree, because it's hitting the headlines these days. It is the subject of judicial or justice reform. So we should talk about its justice reform, which is both include judicial as well as legal reform. And I'm very happy to say that I've got here with me one of the brightest legal minds in Pakistan today. Osama Siddiq, Dr. Osama Siddiq, who is well known in Pakistan, but he has many things to his credit, even though he's a very young man. He set up the LUMS Law Department, but more importantly, he went on to do some very important research in Pakistan. He talked about, he developed a whole book, which has been now published, which is The Experience of the Formal Legal System in Pakistan, which is a wonderfully well-researched book, and which we'll draw upon today. But more important than, but even going further, Dr. Siddiq has also been teaching at Harvard, and he's teaching in many different places, including Thailand and several other countries. So we've got a young talent here who's internationalized himself, who's gone global, and this should give you heart that you can do it too. But Osama Siddiq doesn't stop there. He also has become a writer of fiction now. He's written a wonderful new book of fiction, which has a global and a historical overview. I won't give you much about the book, but nevertheless, I think we'll do a separate podcast on that. His book is called Snuffing Out the Moon. But today we will talk about his area of original expertise, which is law. So we're going to talk about justice reform with Osama Siddiq. Welcome, Osama.
Thank you very much. So kind of you to have me.
Osama, tell us, law and justice reform is such an important topic. And you've been doing some serious research on it. I've seen you've got a couple of very good books on that, which is separate from the books I quoted. Can you please give us an overview? Where should we begin to think about it?
So, at least the way I sort of looked at the state of the justice delivery in this country was to try and combine three different approaches. I feel that a lot of the analysis conducted or undertaken of justice sector reform or judicial institution and other justice sector institution is very ahistorical. And this is quite criminal considering that we are clearly in a post-colonial context. Much has been written about the path dependencies, the vagaries, the challenges of that context. We are also an incredibly complex federal structure, if you think about it, considering that historically so many different federating units have been brought together. We've had a fairly tumultuous post-independence history, constitutional breakdowns and all kinds of things. So I think it's incredibly important to take a look at history and not just think about decontextualized reforms. The second approach, which I've used in my research, is something which lawyers don't necessarily do or legal researchers don't necessarily do, which is a very empirical approach. So essentially relying on data, relying on large surveys, relying on very close sort of case file analysis. So this is different from the historical mode of looking at legal judgments and interpreting legal judgments. This also goes to the people who actually write those judgments and the people who actually face those judges and the lawyers and all that. And the third thing which I've looked at is institutional sociology. I think it's incredibly important to also look at the institutions which actually deliver justice. Who are these people? How are they governed? How are they structured? What is the turf which they try to manage? What are their aspirations? How dated or modern are they in terms of their approaches to governance or internal administration? So I've tried to combine those three approaches in order to arrive at a picture, which hopefully is a picture not only of where we have been or where we started, but where we are now and where are we headed.
So tell us, what do you see? How do you see the system as a whole, and where do we have entry points in terms of, let's first say, understanding the system, then we'll talk about reform.
So I think one will have to compartmentalize the analysis into various aspects, mm-hmm. which one can look at. For instance, one way to look at it is that where exactly is the impetus of reform coming from? Mm-hmm. Or the converse of that, where is it not coming from? How organic, mm-hmm. how indigenous, how rooted in local reality and aspirations is reform? And I say that because Pakistan is incredibly unique. Starting from the early 90s and then especially from the 2000s onwards, it has been one of the largest recipients of foreign aid and loan money in order to undertake justice sector reform. So that really makes the dynamic quite interesting and quite different from, say, India. And it becomes a very interesting case study as to what were the pros and cons and the dynamics and the aspirations of this kind of investment. And then one can also compare and contrast that with earlier, more organic, indigenous efforts to bring about reform. The second way in which one can sort of look at it is in terms of a dichotomy. Has this been reform which has been primarily conceived as a technocratic aspiration? Or has it been reform which actually has any political roots? And this is incredibly important once again because we haven't had political or democratic continuity. Mm-hmm. And the standard sort of pitfall in these kinds of situations can be democratic deficit mm-hmm. and executive shortcuts and transplantation and all kinds of problems which are very well understood in the law and development literature all over the world. Mm-hmm. The third thing to look at is, frankly, the sort of the tensions within the institution. So mm-hmm. how is the judiciary different from the police mm-hmm. or the prosecution or the Home Department in terms of its internal dynamics? How often do they speak to each other? What have been the institutional changes within these institutions? And for that, you really need to look at them jointly, but also independently, because they're complex institutions. The police has been subsumed by its own sort of internal reform debates. The judiciary has had a different trajectory, especially because of its very mega constitutional role, which it has played in the country's politics. So I think it becomes important to look at these places from different lenses. Mm-hmm. Just looking at them from one lens or just looking at one quantifiable output in order to gauge what their progress has been would be very misleading. Mm-hmm. And there are multiple international benchmarks which can be used to look at performance. We'll talk about a few of those. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also important to look at what the aspirations and the real needs of the common citizen are. Mm-hmm. Is there any connection between what the people want and what the system is delivering?
So where do you see as the fundamental weaknesses of the system? I mean, if you had to think about it from the ordinary man's point of view, his interface is the judiciary, and what does he expect of the judiciary?
So let me quote from one particular comparatively recent survey of the Lahore District Courts, which I conducted with my students from Lam some years ago. And mind you, the Lahore District Courts are the most proximate district courts to the seat of power, which is the Lahore High Court. Yep. And one would assume that with all the money flowing in, this would be very much under the gaze. And it turns out that this survey actually revealed a lot of things which were quite surprising even to us. And the most surprising thing is the levels of alienation which people have from the formal legal system. And by alienation, I mean here the fact that how little access they have to resources in order to be able to fight a long legal battle. I mean, some of the things we already knew were confirmed, which is the fact that there's a huge level of longevity when it comes to legal cases. There's no early resolution of legal disputes in a courtroom. There are multiple hearings. Lawyers do take a lot of people for a ride. The traditional mechanisms for out-of-court dispute resolution have essentially withered away. A lot of people find themselves in court not because they want to, but because they don't have any other alternatives or options. So having said that, it turns out that a lot of people are severely handicapped by lack of education, lack of facility in the English language, lack of understanding of even the basic terminology of law, the lack of any access to any legal aid whatsoever, to be completely dependent on a profession, which is the legal profession, which in turn is just very weakly regulated. So you find a lot of people who are really stuck in some level of Dante's Inferno in some ways, because they're just going through the motions. They don't understand what's happening in the court. The judges keep getting transferred. It is an incredibly exhausting and financially ruinous and ultimately inefficient system.
So let's go back into time a little. You did mention that you look at it historically as an evolving system, and that, you know, you're looking at the institutional demands for research, so for judicial reform, as well as you're talking about, you know, not necessarily just relying on data, but getting a more intuitive setup. So historically now, what was the system designed to respond to, and how have its challenges increased or changed?
So, first of all, I think we need to recognize the fact that the entire colonial experience of introducing formal law in this part of the world has three kinds of very broad reactions to it. I mean, I've sort of looked at it in terms of typologies. So there is the standard explanation of the introduction of the great codes in the mid-19th century, or the Contract Act towards the end of the 19th century, as necessary modernization. This is something which ought to have happened, and you know, we should be grateful to the people who actually introduced it. There's another set of thinkers, or there's a literature which talks about this as inevitable modernization. So to their mind, even the remnants of the Mughal legal system would have eventually graduated to something similar. But there's a very vast, very critical literature also, which talks about a radical displacement. They talk about the fact that there were organic ways and means of resolving people's disputes, and also the fact that the way a people's dispute is settled, or are settled, is something very peculiar to a particular culture, to a particular society. And that the very ethos or the philosophy behind this dispute resolution can be very different. For instance, the ethos may be to largely broker peace in a community, to not have outright winners and losers, to not necessarily have an adversarial legal system, to not necessarily conceive of land in terms of very specific alienating ownerships, but to conceive of land as something which is more multifarious and involves a lot of people. So considering that one of the primary sort of imperatives of the colonial rule in this part of the world was revenue extraction and then governance of a certain kind, and they did sort of take forward certain kinds of trends, it was very much something suited to their particular genius and to their rule. It did end up alienating a lot of people, a lot of systems, in a disruptive way. And those people haven't quite recovered from it. Now, having said that, there's a caveat here that it is erroneous perhaps to talk about all of India or all of Hindustan in the same breath, because the experience can be quite different in Madras as compared to Punjab. It boils down a lot to individual administrative officers, the balance of power between the judiciary and the executive in a particular province, the date of its annexation, the kind of local opposition which it met. Not only that, but the colonial formal legal system, its introduction and its ramifications can be quite different from century to century and decade to decade. The other very important thing which one has to be cognizant of is that this was not a very uniform, unproblematic kind of a process whereby they just came up with these codes. There was a lot of guinea pigging. There was a lot of aspirational legislation, because they were deeply frustrated, especially the utilitarians amongst the colonial administrators, with what was going on in England. So you could argue that some of the stuff which they came up with was tailored to local reality. That is the good part. And so it was not direct transplantation from England. But a lot of it was also experimental. And it turns out that it failed time and again. So I think one should look at multiple sources. I looked at Munshi Prem Chand's short stories. He's a very prominent Urdu and Hindi short story writer. So writing in the earlier 20th century, Munshi Premchand has written multiple short stories which talk about the failure of the formal legal system, about the amount of corruption in the system, about how access and privilege can really take you far, about how inhibitions of language and financial prowess can really pull you back. So it's not as if these problems are all post-colonial problems. Some of these problems have been persisting for quite some time. There is also increasingly new evidence to suggest that while they were cognizant of some of these problems, not enough was done to actually address them. Maybe it was not a priority. There's also another very interesting strain of literature which talks about how the colonial treatment of land and their particular approach to land in many ways also conflated things, because land was so deeply embroiled in local sort of politics and all that, that it ended up sort of subsuming any attempts at structuring it and, you know, creating a formal legal system which is consistent. The other really interesting thing moving onwards in history is that there is hardly any questioning of the inheritance of this system by the legal communities of India and Pakistan. You have some very interesting letters from Gandhi where he sort of castigates the profession of lawyer. But by and large, all your founding fathers are legally trained. The negotiation for Pakistan and India in some ways is a legal exercise. And you find lawyers to be tremendously prominent in terms of doing politics when it you know, comes to taking the countries forward. So there is an almost, there's an aura about lawyers and great lawyer leaders, and there is no real questioning of the fact that, look, we just won independence. We have inherited 150 years of colonial governance, may it be your civil administration, may it be your legal adjudication, may it be your prosecution, may it be your police investigation systems. Surely policing could not have been for the same purpose as policing is imagined to be now. You know, the entire notion of policing has changed. So that unquestioned acceptance of these systems and frameworks, of course, can be because of various reasons. And it's the inertia of institutions who have too much else on their plate. It could be self-serving because this is what they used to.
But this is very interesting.
Sure.
I think you've just given us a very interesting and a very quick rendition of where we are right now. You're absolutely right. There were existing indigenous systems, cultures, and ways of handling things. There has to be. We've been around for 5,000 years.
Precisely.
By definition, we had things.
Yeah.
The audacity of the English colonial was that he came in and actually tampered the system. And as you said, it could have been well thought out. It could not have been well thought out. It was a period of experimentation in Victorian England too, where they felt that they, as you said, played around with utilitarianism. They played around with various philosophies, social Darwinism, etc., etc. They tried them out here and they succeeded. To some extent, they succeeded. They did put in a system that was kind of working. We inherited the system, and you're absolutely right. We have an overabundance of lawyers and some very well-educated lawyers, Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard, etc. But you're absolutely right. We have not sat down and questioned the system, right? Now, explain to me, since independence, if my, I mean, I'm just a lay observer, my feeling, and I guess many laymen's feeling in social discussions is that the system is deteriorated, depreciated further rather than improved. And we have made no real effort to change it. You're right, the aid agencies, I remember the Access to Justice program of ADB was there in the 1990s or maybe even the 80s.
Yeah.
And we've since then had much effort in this area. The World Bank also came in, I remember Akhtar Hamid coming here many times and doing judicial reform, etc. There are a number of interventions from outside. Some chief justices have mouthed some kind of reform, but nothing really has happened. Explain to us, why is this the situation?
So I guess one has to sort of look at the two eras slightly differently. So prior to the arrival of the donor programs, we've had a whole series of law commissions. And these law commissions have come up with a whole series of recommendations. But one thing which is common to all those recommendations are that they're incredibly piecemeal. So the entire notion of reform is that you tweak a particular subsection here and you sort of start implementing something there, but the fundamental ethos of the system has never been questioned. I've had the opportunity over the years to deal with some really storied and sort of well-known and senior judges, and it always struck me how they never conceive of a legal system at the level of policy, how law to them is ultimately only doctrine. And doctrine is something which to them is self-explanatory. It's almost as if they are completely not cognizant of the fact that any law or any legal system ultimately is the outcome of a particular political or economic compromise. And that if you change those assumptions or if you change those aspirations, you could have an equally well-functioning alternative legal system. You could have very different laws of inheritance, for instance. And this is an insight which comes to us from early law and economics work in the US from people like Robert Hale, and who sort of spoke about legal realism and spoke about the fact that it's almost a mythology, a story which we are told about the self-explanatory justification of the law. But I saw, and I still see, a lot of the senior legal practitioners to be approaching it that way. So if you talk about law reform prior to the advent of the law reform programs, it is incredibly insular in that sense. The thing with the law reform program is that once again there has been now a couple of generations of these programs. So they have changed as time has passed. But if I talk about the original set of programs, the really major ones, like Access to Justice program, which had $350 million soft loan, is still the largest loan program for justice sector reform anywhere in the world.
Mm.
I think that suffered from a whole set of issues, even if it was well-intentioned, which have to do with this notion that you can actually imagine what ideal reforms are in Washington or in Manila and go to Islamabad and implement them.
Yeah.
Now, they did come at a time when Musharraf was in power. So in some ways, there was no democratic oversight or engagement, but they didn't quite mind. And they spoke to a small coterie of people in very powerful positions. And I call them the Reform Club, a very elitist reform club. The membership is restricted to some senior judges,
right.
some senior bureaucrats, a few exalted international consultants, a few local ones, and that's about it. Nobody else actually hears about when the program came, what happened. They do have, in every program, provision for communication, for stakeholder engagement, but frankly, that's something which was never really done with any level of seriousness. So I think part of the problem with these programs is that they may be more far-reaching than some of the earlier Law Commission reports, because at least they're bringing some notion of international standards or some framework of this is good justice delivery or efficiency. But there's still something which are quite artificial, and there's a lot of literature on why transplantation fails, because we have to look at local context, local needs, local ways of doing things, and tailor things accordingly. I think the second problem is that the way they were structured is that they looked at policy compliance, which can easily turn into a box-ticking exercise. You can talk about 15 things for which the government issued a policy, but you never really invest the time and the effort to embed that reform in an institution, which we now realize is the really hard thing to do, but the really significant thing to do. Because some joint secretary or some chief justice somewhere will sign off on a policy. But once you leave tomorrow, nothing is to be done. The third thing is that a lot of the emphasis was on brick and mortar rather than soft reforms. And soft reforms are much harder, but much more important as well. They also shied away from some of the more complicated reforms, like actually really revisiting the administrative structures of these institutions,
so
really revisiting some of the mega laws like the Civil Procedure Code or the Criminal Procedure Code, which is nitty-gritty work, but which has a lot of long-term impact and on millions of people. So I think the elitist nature of this exercise and the fact that there was no parliamentary or democratic oversight, there was no engagement or dialogue with Pakistanis who were all stakeholders but may have very different expectations, cause these reforms to be imagined in a very narrow technocratic way, in a very court and judge centric way, because you know you can think about justice sector from a very court centric standpoint where everything is a trial, whereas the fact of the matter is that everything does not have to be a trial, everything does not have to go to court, everything does not have to result in imprisonment or travel through an FIR.
Right.
There are multiple modern ways of regulating citizen behavior, creating incentives, you know, creating all kinds of other.
How much of a role does the fact that we, the way our law education system is structured, it's professional colleges, where there's part-time teaching. I don't think we have any legal scholars anywhere in the system.
Sure.
We don't have legal think tanks or think tanks for looking at the legal system or the judicial system. I don't think our law colleges or laws, legal education system has full-time researchers.
So that's a very significant point you make, because any local scrutiny or any local discourse or any local critique obviously is a function of your own capacity to be able to do that. And legal education is unique in Pakistan for the reason that even though elsewhere in the world as well there's this continuing tension between looking at law as an academic exercise and law as a vocational exercise, and you'll find that in most jurisdictions they have both because they need both. In Pakistan, legal education has been a very, there's been a very vocational approach to legal education. Now, why is that the case? I mean, it's an open question. I've asked that question several times. I've done a bit of research on that, which is a separate theme altogether. But the fact of the matter, or the manifestation of that, is that till recently, we only had a large public sector university-based public sector law school model using a very antiquated curriculum, very antiquated pedagogy, relying on practitioners to teach, some of whom are quite good, but you know, there is no theoretical understanding of the law, there's no critical understanding of the law. It's a very vocational approach. Then we sort of moved to a model where we allowed this external LLB program from London University to be taught here. Once again, very little meaningful regulation of what exactly is being taught. Is it relevant to us and who are the teachers? And the incentive structures or the prestige value of being an academic was never there. So the people you had teaching were either those who did it as an off thing for social contribution, or people who couldn't do anything better, or who could not cut it in the profession. We had in the more recent past some experimentation to improve legal education, like the law program at LUMS and a few other initiatives, but it's still very little, considering the amount of challenge in front of us. Now, one of the things which has happened is, and that's really made the problem much more conflated, is that the number of lawyers has really sort of ballooned over the last decade or so.
Yeah.
Now, that creates increasing hurdles, not just for regulating them as a profession, but that also dramatically and very suddenly brings down the quality of how the profession is being practiced. And now there's a real vested interest from amongst these people to push against any possibility of reform, because then they get exposed. And the leadership, which is elected on a very regular basis from amongst these people, also wants to safeguard these people, because they're their constituents,
right.
and they don't really have. So the conventional reasons why a New York bar or a California bar would want to sort of make sure that there's limited entry into the profession is partially they don't want the access to the pie to go to too many people, and it is also partially because of the prestige factor. For various reasons, those two checks don't work here. And because of that very sort of short-sighted approach to the legal profession, quite apart from the fact that there's structural issues in terms of how the profession is regulated, because you have these bar councils who are regulating legal education, even though they have no expertise in doing that. And you have the Higher Education Commission as the co-regulator, but they essentially don't have the capacity to do anything. So you have two regulators and still no regulation. So this is an area which has huge longer term ramifications, because it impacts the kind of lawyers who go to court, the kind of judges who are appointed.
Right.
All the high courts, if you talk to anyone who knows the system right now, will tell you that all the chief justices and all the people who are responsible for appointing new judges are facing a Herculean challenge right now, because there's hardly anyone qualified to be appointed.
There is a general decline in human capital in this country, which I think we can all share.
And the legal education as a place to focus on is something which has also been historically neglected by all these donor programs.
Exactly.
So they wanted quick results, they wanted quantifiable results. I want to make one more point about the basic sort of issue with these programs, is that they had a very narrow efficiency focus on the system.
Okay.
But they did not even go into too much detail in terms of data as to how to gauge efficiency. So efficiency was at a very aggregated level. How soon do the cases get disposed in a courtroom?
Right.
Which is an area which can be discussed ad nauseum, is full of difficulties, because mere disposal does not tell you that the legal system is healthy. Mere disposal does not even tell you that the cases are actually disposed.
Right.
And so that has been a big pain.
Let me ask you, if we think about what are the key challenges of the legal system? I'm trying to break it down in some meaningful sense. Perhaps you'll do better. I'm trying to think, is the key problem just the disposal of cases, the fact that it takes 10, 20 years to get justice? Is it the fact that the process is cumbersome? Is it the fact that somehow the justice system does not do justice? For example, the incidence of liability is not on the right person, the right liability is not placed, or the right sentence is not given. I mean, I'm trying to figure out how do I, in a sense, understand the legal system from a quantitative, let's say, economist or efficiency point of view?
Sure. So to my mind, all the things that you mentioned are actually manifestations of the problem.
Okay.
So the fact that the cases take too long, the fact that there is very little perception of due process during the adjudication of the case, the fact that evidence fails in a lot of cases and there are very low conviction rates, the fact that people generally have a terrible experience dealing with the justice sector functionaries, I think are all governance issues which take you back to how this institution is actually governed.
Okay.
When you go to the governance system of the courts, you will see that these are essentially 19th century institutions which are being forced to function in the 21st century. They have no expertise in pure administration, in human resource management, in data, in technology, all the various things which could actually make the actual administration of justice and its performance management much more efficient. And that has to do both with the fact that it's antiquated in terms of its approach and its personnel and its internal governance rules, but also the fact that it's an incredibly hierarchical and an incredibly insular organization, much more so than any of the other justice sectors. So you may find your own challenges of dealing with the police, but at the end of the day, the police has to work with home, with prosecution, with forensics,
and are much more exposed to public scrutiny and public feedback.
Mm.
And so there are internal debates, and also it's very difficult to go to the police and come away with the notion that there's a single person who stands for all police. No, there are multiple people. In the judiciary, it turns out that things are so hierarchical, they don't have to be, but they are, that whoever is the Chief Justice, and whatever his whims may be, or whatever his proclivities and inclinations, is going to determine what the court does or what it doesn't do. There is absolutely no culture of dissent at the administrative level. I don't think this is written in stone. It's a combination of conventions, culture, and rules. There's a huge... So, quite apart from the fact that if somebody is completely cynical and does not want to do anything, can actually pull the institution down and you can't do anything about it. But if somebody is just not open to the ideas which are essential, there's no way you can get around that, because all roads lead to Rome and all conversations end with the Chief Justice. I think there's a real need to, first of all, meaningfully decentralize the role of the Chief Justice, to also really supplant whatever role they play, which is essentially a judicial role, with experts who can tell them about what policy agenda setting is about, what information and data-based decision-making is about, what setting goals and strategic direction is about. How do you get more administrative people to take a lot of the burden away from you, so you can actually focus on the jurisprudence? The other thing is that this, you know, there is this very problematic conflation of the notion of independence of justice with judicial accountability, lack of judicial accountability. So I can imagine why independence of justice has been used as a mantra, and once again, that's a separate conversation, which is the mega constitutional politics in which the judiciary has been embroiled, as well as the public interest litigation phenomenon. But the fact that judicial accountability has become so much harder, not only do they not hold themselves accountable, and so the Supreme Judicial Council is a case in point, but they also are increasingly very desirous of not only controlling all their affairs, but not being beholden to anyone. Citizenry, government, other stakeholders. At the same time, there's also the problematic trend that they seem to be not even beholden to the Constitution. Because they often talk about being directly accountable to the public.
But
when you're directly accountable to the public, you're a politician. You have to fight an election.
Right.
And you have to face the consequences of people's angst when they're not happy with them. So I think this is this insularity combined with an antiquated governance system, and the fact that judiciaries all over the world tend to be the most conservative institutions, has created a situation where they're really lagging behind. And so to give you an example, because I often get an opportunity to teach in the rest of Asia and other parts of the world, there are some fundamental ways of governing the judiciary, like the case flow management system. Where people, and these are developing countries I'm talking about, are at a stage where they started this process 10 to 15 years ago, and now are dealing with more advanced second, third order issues of how to tweak it further. We haven't even begun the conversation in a meaningful fashion.
So what is case flow management?
So case flow management is nothing but a set of principles and tools whereby the court ensures that it is exclusively in control of the pace and the progress of legal cases. Neither the litigants nor the lawyers can actually influence what you have already set as an agenda in terms of prioritizing cases, in terms of dividing cases into different tracks, in terms of your policy priorities, essentially deciding how you expedite some cases over others and how you meet certain timelines, targets, calendars, schedules. So in a case flow management system, as a litigant, you would have a much better idea as to when you should expect an outcome. It would also be a much shorter period of time. And the process itself will also be less cumbersome, because there will be far fewer adjournments or hearings where no progress takes.
So you're saying I won't be able to get a stay?
You will be able to get a stay when it is really necessary, or where it is something which the requirements of the law you know, allow for it. But stay would not be used as a random tool for coercion.
As routinely as it is done now.
Not now, or adjournments, or just... So the way the system is currently structured is that it is the ideal system if you want to embroil someone. It is exactly the worst mechanism if you actually want to get an outcome.
Right.
You want to reverse that. And so what happens under case flow management is that you have multiple tools, but the basic idea is that you divide various categories of cases according to their very nature and to their complexity into different types. So once your case falls in a particular type, it has to fall within that timeline. Secondly, you make the judge sit down with the litigants and their lawyers and decide on a calendar of activities, on the number of hearings, on the number of documents which will be produced, on the number of witnesses. There will be some room to maneuver, but by and large, we are now circumscribed by what we've agreed to. So the possibility of abusing the system goes down. Also, what goes down is the possibility of abusing individual judges, because you're working under a larger framework, under the scrutiny of people whom the litigants can't directly influence.
Sure.
In addition to this, what you also do is that you tighten your pre-trial scrutiny so that a lot of frivolous litigation which really burdens your system goes away. You ensure that a lot of cases which mandatorily should go into arbitration or into out-of-court dispute resolution are actually pushed in that direction early on in the case. You also make sure that every hearing counts so that there is some progress on that hearing.
Yeah.
And once you start collecting data according to this segmented envisioning of the system, you can actually monitor it very well. You can exactly find out at which stage of the case who is responsible for creating unnecessary delay. And that is not really rocket science.
But does this not overburden the judges?
So I think
will this not kind of put the judges under greater pressure? They already say they've got a huge amount of cases on the table.
So what is necessary to also implement the system is to create a cadre of professional managers, which every self-respecting court in the world...
Right now, the judges are managers themselves.
Right,
that's the problem, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so what you need is a cadre of people who actually facilitate the judges' jobs. They not only will that make sure that your performance management and your evaluation of different judges is according to objective and fair standards. So you can qualitatively and quantitatively measure the performance of judges according to these well-known parameters. But you also have people who do this work, who collect the data, process the data, who reduce it to a readable decision-making, facilitating kind of a sort of a form. And it's not a huge investment, it's a one-time investment. This is a dynamic process. You will constantly, the society is constantly changing, the system has to respond to that. You will set your targets every year. No system in the world tries to expedite every single kind of case. There are some which you prioritize, but right now that dialogue does not even take place. So what happens is this very sort of knee-jerk, ill-informed attempt at governance, which often has no desirable results. So the mantra for reform over the last decade and a half has been delay reduction. But there has been no meaningful long-term structural mechanism to ensure that delay has actually reduced or that the disposals have gone down. And one of the reasons for that is that if you look at the data from any of the high courts and the district courts, much as some attempts have reduced backlog and taken up disposal, the gap between newly instituted cases and disposals is constantly growing. This is a society with a lot of litigation. We need to find out why. I mean, actually it goes to a fundamental question. Why are there so many disputes which then turn into litigation? So I think there's a larger sociological inquiry here which is incredibly important. Is it because certain laws are so problematic that they lend themselves to litigation? Is it because litigation is so easy that you can actually embroil any dispute into litigation and ruin the other party, you know, so using law as a coercive mechanism? Is it because there are certain imbalances in society or certain contestations which need to be addressed at the political and economic level, otherwise legal issues will always persist? So I think this is a larger debate, which is why you can't leave the reform of the justice system just to the judges. First of all, it's very counterintuitive. You're going to these judges, you think they're not performing very well, and now you're asking them to reform themselves.
It's like letting the alcoholic reform himself.
Precisely.
So you need to.
It doesn't happen. Leaving the bottle with him and telling him to sort of overcome the sort of temptation. The second problem is because this is not just a purely court-based technocratic matter. There are economic and political ramifications. There are also imperatives which are larger governmental or state imperatives, which is why that these people should be talking to each other. Roughly half the litigation in the courts involves the government. It's important for the government and everybody else to sit down and figure out how this incredibly costly and burdensome phenomenon can be dealt with. So, but you have instead a judicial framework which is hierarchical, as I said, insular, which does not talk to other people, which does not understand modern governance or technology or all these things. And whenever you sort of try and persuade them to start looking at this, they yell murder and they say you're trying to violate our independence.
And which nobody is researching in any case. I've seen no no papers or conferences to discuss any of these issues that you've raised, and these are fundamental issues which should be raised and discussed, I think, ad nauseum. But let me take you another direction. So you said hierarchical, you're absolutely right. But I often wonder, I mean, we've got roughly a three-tier system, if I'm right, right? We've got a Sessions Court, which is the place where things begin. Then we've got the High Court, then we've got the Supreme Court. Now, the way I look at it is, and this is the system that was set up in colonial India when most of the population was rural, and the mode of business was just basically buying and selling land and some agricultural transactions. Now we've moved to a modern economy where the transactions are getting more and more complex. International transactions are coming in. Previously, we didn't have international transactions like RICO, DIC, and various things are coming in. At the same time, we got industry, we got finance, we got so many different avenues I would say transactions, and I would say society is getting far more complex. You're getting, let's say, multiple ownership buildings, all kinds of things, multiple ownership firms. Is this three-tier system based on a rural setting capable of dealing with all this, or how should we reconfigure it?
So let me say two things. I think I quite agree that, first of all, the kind of functional specialization that you need in the court system, and also the kind of more sophisticated expertise which is required for some of these really important transactions is not quite there. So it's luck of the draw. You know, you appoint judges through a process which is still more or less translucent at best. You are sort of taking people from a larger sort of pool, which is not a very rich pool to start with. The way the institution is structured is not going to necessarily attract your top corporate lawyers to actually take up a judicial career, which is something which needs to be thought about, because some of these transactions are incredibly important. Now, the knee-jerk reaction in the past to all kinds of new social economic phenomenon has been to create a new category of courts. So you have special courts for recovery of loans, you have tax tribunals, there are 50 odd types of courts. Now, what happens is that sometimes they start off okay, because they have a slightly expedited system of doing things. But eventually, they all sort of become rigid, or they all sort of become dependent on the rest of the system. And since the rest of the system has not been reformed, they are little islands who either get subsumed by the water, or they find it very hard to function. So, I mean, I think there's no getting around the fact that there is a wholesale envisioning of the judicial system, which ought to be based on a very careful calculation of what exactly are the kinds of disputes which are now in society. I mean, I was looking at a recent set of data about the crime trends in Faisalabad and Lahore, and it turns out there is a major shift to crimes against property. So that means policing also has to be not your conventional policing, thinking of crime only in terms of murder or abduction. It's the more sophisticated property crimes as well as the everyday robbery kind of a thing which has to be looked into. I think the same holds true for adjudication. You know, well, some of the positive things which are happening in our context is that Punjab right now has a very sophisticated forensic science laboratory. The other positive thing is that, considering that standalone, relatively autonomous prosecution departments are comparatively a more recent phenomenon in all the provinces, the prosecution departments have grown in their capacity and their role. There is some internal debate and definitely greater technological empowerment when it comes to the police. They have much more capacity for monitoring and sort of collecting evidence. But that still does not translate into more convictions, more successful investigations, because the way in which the evidence is collected and the way the judges still look at it is in a different century. So you will have to look at reform, first of all, in a dynamic fashion in terms of how society is changing. And your corporate transactions are another part of the same phenomenon, because you'll have sophisticated crime, you'll have sophisticated corporate transactions. You need a very sort of dexterous approach to it. You need to be talking to each other and have a larger generic policy, quite apart from individual strategic policy direction for all these departments. You will need many different people of very, very new and different skill sets now working with these institutions. Here, what happens is that whether you are setting up a training institute, or you're setting up an internal technology unit, or you're setting up a new human resource management cell in the court, you appoint a district and session judge to head it. I think there's a big challenge in terms of even training our district session judges to become better district and session judges, let alone expecting them to understand data, technology, training, and human resource management. I mean, these are things which they've not even heard of before. The conventional sort of excuse given is that our hiring mechanisms are very problematic, so change them. I mean, how long can we keep making the same argument? I mean, the point is that there's growing frustration, and there is a very clear sort of evidence that the courts are sort of falling far behind in terms of delivering, not just on disposal of cases, but coming up with clear, far-reaching, forward-looking jurisprudence when it comes to citizens' rights or harmonious economic transactions or direct foreign investment or sovereignty. Yes, they have a lot of challenges and one's sympathies are with them, but they can make their lives easier themselves.
Let me put it another way. How much of the fault lies with the legal system? How much of the fault, I mean, so far you've stressed the justice system and you've pointed out all kinds of flaws in justice system, which I must say are eye-opening and they're absolutely phenomenal. And since my audience here really is the student population, I really think that what you've thrown up is a number of questions that I hope young people will be attracted to and join your research brigade, because I think a lot of research, a lot of thought needs to come out on this. But going further, let's see. Apart from the judicial system, our legal system, you mentioned the Civil Procedure Code, our legal system is also from the 19th century. And many things have not been revised. How do we modernize the legal system? Or is there a need to modernize the legal system, or can we live with that?
So I think the fault also does definitely lie with our lawmakers. There's very little legislation, and much of that legislation is of very poor quality. And we think of legislation in a very narrow, conventional, archaic way, the way we write those laws. And if you go to the law department and look at their capacity, which I'm sure you have, you'd be appalled. Part of it has to do with the kind of oxygen or legislative space which the governments actually get. So I'm not trying to defend them. But it is a fact that by and large they've had shorter stints in power. They've been embroiled. They have been too caught up with actual service delivery in their constituencies. And then they have been trying to either entrench themselves or to fight for their survival. And so we've had a lot of interruptions. But still, I think we could have shown more for it in terms of legislation. I think legislation, new rulemaking, people think of it as a very technocratic exercise, which is far from it. Basically, law is a language which crystallizes what you've thought through in terms of what you want to do economically and politically. Does it come as a surprise to you that if you look at the manifestos of all your political parties before the last election, they have very rudimentary understanding or engagement with what they want to do with the legal system? Right. What is their notion of rights?
Right.
How do they look upon the federation? What does contract enforcement mean to them? What do gender rights mean to them? What does vulnerability mean to them? If you look at the one particular party, it turns out that they have 10 bullet points, of which 5 were actually dated. If you look at another political party, it is mostly what they say is rhetorical, but there's nothing concrete. If you ask the leading functionaries of these parties even today, and I've had occasion to do that at times, none of them can actually go into any depth in terms of understanding, even though some of them extol the fact that their party stands for justice. What does it mean? The other big problem here is that there is also this notion, even amongst some of the parliamentarians, which I hinted at earlier as well, that somehow law is some technical thing for the technicians. Far from it. You know, the law, as I said, is a language, a tool, a mode of negotiation. Yes, it has an internal logic. Yes, it has an internal mechanism. There's a something scientific to it as well. But ultimately, I think the biggest fallacy which we are suffering from is that we tend to couch questions which are controversial, but which are inherently economic and political. As David Kennedy, who's done a lot of work in the law and development sphere on this, tells us in the context of international law, where he says that economic and political contestations get disguised and reduced to legal contestations. Because you're trying to escape from the fact that there are some hard economic and political questions to answer. I think that's also very true for the domestic context, where, you know, things are over-legalized. You will see how in our talk shows, you have everybody and their aunt sort of trying to pretend to be a legal technician. And people who don't necessarily have an undergraduate education trying to interpret constitutional provisions or statutory provisions. Great that people are actually talking about something like that. But you know, there's something ape-like about these things. what's much more important is that people talk politics. Mm-hmm. People talk about the fundamental outcomes they would like to see in society, the kind of society they want to see.
Mm-hmm.
And that in turn then sort of allows for a use of laws and legal frameworks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to make this less technocratic, more political, more open to various kind of constituents.
Mm-hmm.
We have to speak in the vernacular. We have to make it less elitist.
Mm-hmm.
I think the legal discourse in this country is also
mm-hmm.
prohibiting and sort of elitist, because it's just not decipherable by a vast majority of people.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because it's in English, but also because law uses a specialized language.
Yeah.
Which very few people understand. There's a snobbery around it.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
You know, isn't it remarkable that despite all these multi-million programs and a lot of other things, you still don't necessarily have all your major laws translated into simple Urdu for people to read?
Yeah. Yeah.
And even though most of the proceedings in the law courts actually do take place in Pashto, Sindhi,
yeah.
Saraiki, Punjabi, and Urdu,
yeah.
with a mixture of English.
Yeah.
So, and the language which they use in Urdu, at least, the terminology is some archaic Mughal Urdu,
yeah.
which is equally difficult. So I think we are sort of definitely creating a system which is extremely alienating.
Hmm. You're right, even in the US, I think you probably are aware of this, this professor Cass Sunstein, you know, he went into the Obama government for a while. And he started a program for simplification of laws.
Yes.
In fact, he's written a book called Simple. He's just saying, hey, let's make it.
Late 1990s, when I was a lawyer practicing in New York, they came up with the plain English rules.
Yeah.
And so which, you know, met with some issues, because one can imagine that there are certain sophisticated concepts and debates which don't necessarily lend themselves to always being
practiced. But the effort must be made.
No, they did, because they realized that, for instance, the kind of paperwork which they produced in securities transactions,
yeah.
and the 70 to 80 page dossiers,
right.
which are then circulated amongst the potential sort of shareholders,
yeah.
are simply not
decipherable.
So they had to start translating them, and
right.
people had to start
right.
learning a new language.
Right.
And so this is a recognition in a country where the native language is English.
Mm.
We're talking about Pakistan, with a very, very disparate
yeah.
access to education,
right.
to resources, to lawyers, and to the language.
Mm.
And yet we're persisting with something which would be very much of a misfit even in Dickens' times. And yet we persist with that.
So, I hear you. But Osama, honestly, you've sort of left me more depressed than I began with. Because I don't see anyone even anywhere close to appreciating what you're saying.
I think depression maybe is the necessary first step to move towards perhaps some reform.
Mm.
A lot of the people in the sector whom I meet are not even depressed.
Mm.
And this false sense of elation with which they carry on, completely not cognizant of how millions upon millions of people suffer under the system on a daily basis.
Mm.
I think it's also important to humanize this story. A lot of the discourse is in terms of disposable numbers, which too is not accurate. I think it's incredibly important also for our filmmakers, for our writers, for various kinds of people who raise public awareness. You know, we use this term in a very empty sense, demand-side programs, which don't do anything. I think it's important to just follow the stories of the people who are attending their 727th hearing in a 16-year-old litigation. I'm just, you know, pulling these numbers out of here. Or people who have lost their entire property while trying to sort of safeguard whatever little they have. And all kinds of things which carry on around this legal system. This is not to take any credit away from those highly upright people and hardworking people who, despite this incredibly difficult environment, still turn up for their jobs and do a good job. I mean, hats off to them that they do it in this context. But unless and until we embrace the fact that we have systemic issues, we have deeply entrenched issues, and that no amount of tinkering or sort of varnishing is going to take away this problem.
But Osama, isn't that a central problem in everything that we do? The civil service system, the judiciary, the police, even the army, even the way we run our cities. I mean, I've been talking about this a lot. But the issue is, these are all systemic issues. And unfortunately, in our society, we have no space for discussing systemic issues. Getting deeper into a subject, we have absolutely no space to do that, unfortunately.
And which is why I think, and you have much more experience of looking at the international context and you know, these reform discourses and the lack of space or the privileged space and crowding out and all that. I mean, I think there is no answer but politics. I mean, politics is the weapon to create space, right? I mean, the entire contestation in many ways, prior to the French Revolution or to any other sort of more cataclysmic change or more incremental change, was the fact that there were a whole bunch of people who thought that nobody heard them, or who thought that the way the national resources were being directed was in a manner which was completely unfavorable to their interests, but there was no space. So we are a deeply politically deep, we're a deeply depoliticized society. And that's not in a vacuum. I mean, there have been military governments in this country who have spent all their energy and resources trying to depoliticize us by giving politics a bad name, by making people cynical, by extolling the virtues of a knight in shining armor who's some technocrat from some agency coming in. We are still not very keen on the idea of local government. There is very little interest in deeper politics, even when it comes to television shows. It's mostly about sensationalism. You know, it's mostly this vicarious pleasure about seeing someone fall, someone in power. But that's about it. And I think the blame goes to the political parties, but the blame also goes to the armchair commentators who will not even turn up for a simple civil society protest. But they will sit there and pontificate on what Vladimir Putin should do or what Donald Trump should do, but they will not do something in their own union council. That's beneath them. I'm also part and parcel of that. So there is the value of academics and thinkers and technocrats, but I think there needs to be a larger engagement in politics, and we need to stand up for things which are important to us. Nobody gives you space. I don't think that has happened in human history. You have to snatch it. But you have to do something to be able to do that.
No, fair point. My sort of the issue that remains in my mind is that these are such complex issues. What you raised today, even I'm having a hard time grasping them, right? And I think, quite frankly, in order to grasp these fully, we need at least a few hundred people like you who are able to debate and discuss this. Just like as I think in economics, and I keep saying that, I say, guys, we need at least 100 economists who can at least sit together and discuss these things, because, you know, ultimately discussion and debate produces thought and, you know, allows you to figure out the nuances, allows you to figure out the complexities, and then you can put it to the general public. Unfortunately, we lack those clusters of thinkers who can create the space.
I agree with you. I mean, you need cluster, you need the ability to push back, you need discourses.
Yeah.
But, so I'm not at all denying the fact that that is invaluable, and we need to do that as well. But I would also think that we don't necessarily need to do it in the conventional way.
Yeah.
So clusters don't have to be actual in the same place. They can be virtual.
Absolutely.
I have had the privilege and the opportunity to visit a lot of neighboring countries on a very regular basis. I go to India very frequently, and I'm deeply interested in the commonality of the various legal issues, as well as how they are dealing with it, and people in various academic institutions. There's hardly any structured debate between us, or the reason that...
Correct.
The fact that we have this entire tension, visas don't get issued and all, also precludes the fact that 20 very good economists from India can actually sit together with 20 good economists from Pakistan, or lawyers, or academics.
Yeah.
And mind you, there is a dearth of such people even there.
Yeah.
But if you bring them together in the SAARC countries, for example, you have something much better than
fair
before.
Point.
So I think those forums, those engagements, the use of technology to bring people together, and to set common agendas of research and discussion and policy thinking are invaluable. I agree with you. Because there's a lot of noise, I'm sorry to say, which drowns out any quotient debate.
Absolutely.
I think we also need to simplify our message. So I think there is a time and place for high-level theoretical disagreements. But I think sometimes those need to be set aside in order to come up with a common message that, look, yes, you and I may have somewhat of a different view about the history or the trajectory or the shape of the Civil Procedure Code, but here's the commonality. We feel that the following 7 sections should be amended immediately. And then I think it's also about advocacy. How do you communicate that message? How do you simplify it?
Okay.
Not to make it unintelligible.
I think that's a very good point. Very good point. Absolutely correct. We as academics or thinkers are not only responsible for doing good research, but also making the research intelligible to the ordinary mass of people as well, not just talk to each other. So you're absolutely right, we must simplify our messages. Now, this has been wonderful, great discussion. We have to do it much more. But let me ask you, I want to do some follow-up episodes with you, but before you go, I have to ask you a couple of questions that I ask most of my guests.
Sure.
One is, since I hope that people, young people are listening to it, some of them are in schools, going to do some theses and papers for, you know, their bachelor's, master's, or whatever degrees. Would you, from your research, what would you recommend? 2 or 3 ideas that these people can pick up and probably start because I think it's important to get them to think along these lines.
No, I think that's a very valid question because one does get approached by people quite frequently. I'm slightly reluctant at times to suggest areas because I want people to push themselves a bit
Fair enough.
And in this day and age, I think it's important for them to identify a question which is important thing, and it should be close to their heart.
Good point.
Rather than somebody else telling them. So for me, the debate I have with them is mostly methodological.
Okay.
Once they've chosen the question or a set of questions, I push them or I engage with them to figure out, okay, so what are the different ways of asking this question?
Yeah.
How can you cut it in different ways? But I think any question which now descends a bit from the level of abstraction, which is a big issue because people like to try and solve everything through one question. I think the question should be narrower. The question should go to the heart of institutional performance, not look at the manifestation. So questions about corruption are problematic to me because I'd much rather look upon corruption as a manifestation and talk about what exactly it is in police investigations which caused them to be hijacked, which caused evidence to fail in a court of law, which causes witnesses to resile, you know, things like that. So I would urge them to sort of do a little bit more reading. And it's easier now than it was 20 years ago because there is stuff available on the internet. And try and see how other people have asked those questions in other contexts and try and learn a bit about the system. So that little bit of research prior to... So it shouldn't be that they wake up one morning and say, I'll dedicate half an hour to framing the question and then 99 days to the research. I'd rather they spend 5 days thinking through the question. Once they bring that question to that level of detail, then it becomes much easier for you and I or anyone else to actually further help them and to guide them.
Okay.
So I think that would be one major advice.
Good.
And then I think they have to be emotionally involved with that question. This is not completely, you know, an unemotional exercise. They have to feel for the context in which they exist. And they have to think back about actual human experiences around them. Because sometimes the best questions emerge from your own or the people's experiences around you. Because those are much more unadulterated manifestations of what the system is all about. And thirdly, I think they should not think about disciplines in a compartmentalized fashion. So a good question will probably have multiple facets to it. There'll be an economic dimension, a political one, often really. So I think it's also important through these questions and this research to understand the intricate relationship between these disciplines and to try and be more sort of multifarious.
All very good ideas. Let me throw this at you. I've often felt this, and perhaps you as a younger sort of blossoming academic, you might wish to reflect upon it. I also found, at least in my subject, economics, you know, where I interact much with the younger people, I find that we become very timid in our research.
Yes.
We tend to look for questions in international journals, and then we tend to copy those methodologies and questions and try and transplant them here. And I keep telling them, and I have to tell myself this too, hey, I see this problem right here. It may not be an American problem, an English problem, and I might not have the best methodology to deal with it, but I should at least try and answer it the best way I can.
Absolutely. No, I think that's very valid. I think part of it is driven by the constraints of international publishing.
Yeah.
So that's a big issue, and that's a separate debate. But I think... while it is incredibly important and beneficial to look at how and what people are researching elsewhere, just to see how cleverly they ask their questions, how do they structure their query and their research, the questions have to be the questions have to be organic. The questions have that does not mean that you have to have a unique question which has never been asked in Bangladesh.
Right.
It may have been, but I think it is important to not ignore the local context and to look at that.
And what you said about being emotionally involved. That's very important. That's extremely important. Finally, recommend a book or a movie or whatever you like that you think
that
these kids should read or see or whatever.
Well, I'm reading your book.
Okay.
So I would recommend that because at this very early stage, what goes for it is that it's stepping out of the box. It's not trying to structure it in a particular discourse, but trying to question a lot of fundamental assumptions and trying to say, let's have a clean slate and imagine ourselves in a future, which is a different future, and then let's work backwards. And the advantage of that approach is that you actually shed a lot of the debris and the burden of assumptions and biases and prejudices, and you're forced to imagine a different future and work your way backwards, which I think is a very interesting way of doing it. And I'm not too far into the book to be able to comment on the substantive side of it. Let the readers explore it themselves.
Okay.
But I think it's a very refreshing way to look at things, and I would urge people to read widely and to read something like that.
Well, that's very nice. Thank you. Thank you very much, Sama. That was wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you.
सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।